History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Welcome back, everyone, in our series on key battles on World War I. We spent the first two episodes just setting the stage because the stage is the size of planet Earth and there is a lot to discuss. When we ended the last episode, James and I were talking about how it seemed a giant machine had been set in motion with World War I, and at some point it couldn't stop even if the participants wanted to. Was it enough that Gavrilo Princip happened to assassinate Franz Ferdinand? If that would have been prevented, could World War I have been prevented? No one can know, but we veered toward probably not. Now we're going to get into World War I proper and look at the first of our 10 key battles, which is the Battle of Tannenberg. So, James, set us up here. What's happening with the plans for the war? Everyone has a plan. People have been planning for years or decades. What's going on with all that?
All right, before I actually get into that, if it's okay, I want to first of all issue a correction.
Please. There will be many to come from both of us, so that's fair.
Yeah, I said, this is not Scott's doing, this is on me, but last time we were talking about how the German leadership threatened if the British Expeditionary Force, the small British army, if they came over to the continent, I said that the Kaiser said, oh, we'll just have them arrested, which is a funny call, but it was actually Otto von Bismarck that said that. So sorry about that, folks. I was close.
He's got plenty to say, and we'll do our best here, people. We'll make little mistakes. And James and I were saying that for the drinking game for this series, we don't know what it will be. It might be mispronunciation of German or French words. If it's a Serbian word, James has that locked down. If it's a Turkish word, I've got it locked down. Watch out. But if it's other languages, all I can say is we're doing our best. James has even consulted with a native French speaker. So there you go.
Yes, we've got independent consultants working for us on this one. So we're trying, people. All right. So we're going to talk primarily about the key battle today, the Battle of Tannenberg. But I'm also going to, as we always do, I'm going to sneak in some more battles because I'm not going to try to cover, or we will not try to cover every single battle in World War I. This would take forever. We would never finish in our life, probably. But we're going to focus on the 10 key battles, but we will mention a few others that I feel really need to be in there. And they are, some of them could have, you know, very reasonably could have made the cut of the 10. But so what we're going to talk about is just the outbreak of the war in general. It was marked by the breakdown of the Western powers' war plans. Leaders on both sides experienced surprises, shocks, and the failure of plans. And of course, that always happens. You know, the old quote about how the first thing that goes away when a war starts is the plans, right? The plans on paper always have to get tossed. And the first few months of World War I saw shocking violence on a scale never experienced before, at least not in Western Europe, and really probably not in Eastern Europe either. We're going to see massive armies. And at the beginning of the war, for the first couple months, they're going to just be slugging it out. And in the words of the great podcaster Dan Carlin, he likes to use the analogy of a boxing match. He said there were many haymakers thrown and both sides hit the floor several times and got right back up again. So it's going to be kind of a free-for-all at first. And I want to start, before we even talk about Russia and Germany, I want to talk about Austria and Serbia. The spark that lit the flame that turned into the war was, of course, the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand by Gavrilo Princip, a Bosnian Serb. What did, and we saw in the previous episode that the Austrian government sent an ultimatum to the Serbian government, and it was designed to be rejected. It was just over the top absurd, ridiculous. And of course, it was rejected, at least, I mean, most of it was accepted, but it wasn't 100% accepted. So Austria declared war on Serbia, and the next day they started bombarding Belgrade. I'll just say Belgrade. In Serbian, it's Beograd, but we'll just use the English version, Belgrade. And a few weeks later, on August 12th, the Austrian army actually marched into Serbia, using many soldiers that Austria-Hungary had promised Germany that they would send against Russia. So, right. Yeah, the Austrians were really fixated on Serbia. They really hated Serbia. especially their chief of staff, basically the head general of the army, a man named Konrad von Hotzendorf. He many times had asked to declare war against Serbia, but it was rejected, at least until 1914. Now, the Serbs had mobilized about 500,000 soldiers from a population of only 4 million. That's pretty impressive. That's 1/8 of the population. But many Serb soldiers did not have weapons or ammunition. But what they did have was a lot of confidence and motivation. They also had better technology and more combat experience. Keep in mind, they had been fighting in wars very recently. There were two Balkan wars in 1912 and 1913. And so a lot of these young men, or not even young men, middle-aged men in some cases, were battle-hardened veterans. And again, to use Carlin's phrase, I love Dan Carlin's podcast on World War I. Carlin says they punched above their weight class. So in other words, Serbia was kind of a lightweight. It was far from being a great power, but it fought like at least a middleweight. And in 4 months of fighting, the Serbs held off the Austrians, and the Austrians ended up retreating back into Bosnia, which of course is part of Austria-Hungary at this time, on December 15th, and they suffered over 100,000 casualties. Now, I want to take just a second, and once again, for those who may not have listened to our Civil War or Revolutionary War series, I want to define what a casualty is. A casualty of war means someone who is either wounded, killed, captured, or just gone missing. And this war, there's going to be a lot of missing because the technology of artillery is so great that people will literally be blown to bits and their bodies are never found. Anyway, so they seem to just disappear. So 100,000 casualties. Again, that doesn't mean 100,000 killed. It means that many killed, wounded, captured, and missing. But that's still very impressive for a small army like Serbia with only 500,000 people fighting off the Austrian army, which was much larger, and giving them 100,000 casualties. Now, during the invasion of Serbia, I should mention that the Austrian army committed many atrocities against Serb civilians. They executed 3,500 in the first 2 weeks alone. And they were not ashamed of this. They didn't try to cover it up. The Austrians saw this as a legitimate way of waging war, to inflict terror into the heart of the people they're fighting against. And we're going to see the Germans are going to do this in Belgium too. The Austrians would actually take and publish photos of the victims. Some people they just shot and executed. Some they crucified. They did all kinds of really nasty things, and the Serbs still remember it to this day. And Scott was going to bring out a few other things about that too.
Yeah, I just want to mention this as an aside before we get too far into this narrative. World War One is, in many ways, the first mass media propaganda war that takes place in the background of a war. Now, war correspondents have been involved in earlier wars. English correspondents were in the Crimean War, and that turned a lot of the public opinion against the Ottomans. But things change in World War One, and James mentioned taking pictures of these victims, but there's something else that is a game changer, and you'll scratch your head when I say it. Here's what it is. Postcards. James, do you ever send a postcard except where maybe you're at a state park or whatever and you want to send it back to someone? And are you a big postcard aficionado?
I used to be, not so much lately.
Okay, so here's what I'm talking about. The postcard was at its high watermark around World War One. It was invented in Austria in 1870. It was just sort of a gimmick by the post office to reduce time and postage of the letter writing, but they became really popular. They had artwork and photographs on them so people could quickly fire off a personal message. And in World War One, millions of civilians and soldiers used them to send quick messages back and forth. I mean, sometimes a soldier could only send something like, I am well, or I am wounded, I am receipt of your letter, something they could fire off quickly from the front. But what happens here is that they're also used as fodder for propagandists. There are people who are making illustrations of violence perpetrated by the enemy, or political cartoons where you see the Lady Britannia or whatever, like the symbol of Britain being attacked by a giant gorilla, which is Germany. And Britain really didn't have a lot of animosity against Germany before the war. They were allies in a lot of situations. But as a tool of propaganda, postcards were what inflamed this. So violent acts that we're going to see later on, like what happens in Belgium and other places, there are artistic depictions of this. And people are using it on postcards and sending it to each other. And it sounds weird. It would be like having a picture of Abu Ghraib 10 years ago from the Iraq war. But this is just part of this massive pictorial propaganda campaign that's taking place. So people look at each other as mortal enemies, and that's part of it. So everything from postcards on down are being mobilized for the war. So I just want to mention that real quick.
Yeah, that's amazing. Let's move over now to the actual war between Germany and Russia. And Scott, you wanted to kind of give a little background on that as well?
I was going to mention some skirmishes, but there's not really much to say. Suffice it to say, there are some border conflicts before hundreds of thousands of soldiers are mobilized. But let's jump into it. So what happens when Russia invades Germany?
Yeah, I have to set the stage by saying there's a part of Germany at this time. The German Empire, Germany proper, I should say, is very large. It's much larger than Germany is today. Germany is really huge in 1914. It's going to be pared down somewhat after the war. So the World War II Germany is a little bit smaller, and then modern Germany is still smaller today. But kind of the sacred heart, if you will, of Germany was a region called Prussia. And we talked about that previously. Prussia was an independent kingdom that arose in the early modern period and got more and more powerful. It was famous for its military prowess. The Prussians were descendants of the Teutonic Knights. They were a group of medieval monks/knights, warrior monks, if you will, who went and tried to take over parts of Russia in the east and convert the Russians to Catholicism. But the Teutonic Knights took over a lot of Slavic lands, and they intermarried with the Slavs, and their descendants were the Prussians. And of course, a lot of our listeners have heard of Frederick the Great of Prussia, one of the greatest military leaders of all time. And there was an elite class called the Junkers, who were kind of like the warrior nobles, if you will. And they are going to end up being the great military leaders, the commanders, the generals in Prussia. And then their descendants will be the leaders of the German army. And all these guys with the von in their name, like, von Hindenburg, Paul von Hindenburg, he was a descendant of a Junker. And so this region, Prussia, and especially East Prussia, is their ancestral homeland. So it's very, very important to the Germans, that region is. It's kind of like, the United States, we wouldn't want to lose Washington, D.C., or maybe we would.
Yeah. Starting to get people thinking, that's,
Maybe that, yeah, bad, not, maybe that's not the best analogy, but think about Jerusalem, the importance of Jerusalem to so many different peoples and other places that are just so important. Kosovo to the Serbs, Paris to the French. That's the importance of Prussia. The problem with East Prussia, though, is it's right next to Russia. Prussia is next to Russia at the time. And so when the Russians attack, it's going to be into East Prussia. And that's exactly what happened. We'll talk more about the Schlieffen Plan actually in our next episode. We chose to start with the East first. But the Schlieffen Plan for now, let's suffice it to say that it was Germany's way of trying to knock out France very, very quickly and then deal with Russia, who they knew would attack them. Germany didn't want to have to fight a two-front war. Obviously, that's a losing scenario in most cases. You don't want to fight France on your west and Russia on the east at the same time. So the plan was to march quickly into France, knock them out in just a few weeks, and then turn around and deal completely with Russia to, put all your strength against Russia. And that was predicated on the idea that the Russian army would be very, very slow in mobilizing, and meaning getting their army ready, getting organized, and marching in up to the battlefield. However, Russia was not as slow as Germany had hoped. They were much quicker. It just took them a couple of weeks to get going. They had already done some kind of preliminary mobilization. And they had two very large armies, the First Army and the Second Army, very creatively named. And they were facing against just one German army in East Prussia. So the Germans were vastly outnumbered. It was at least 2-1, maybe a little bit more. On August 7th, Russian forces crossed into Germany. They invaded the region of East Prussia, where the Germans had relatively few soldiers, as I mentioned. The Russians were hoping to capture the city of Königsberg, which is the city where Prussian kings were always coronated, and it was the ancient capital of Prussia. Today it's actually Kaliningrad in Russia, but that's a story for another time. And the Russians were hoping to cut off that German army. They were hoping to do a double envelopment and get around it, surround it, and wipe it out. The Germans, for their part, were determined not to lose Königsberg. There were two battles on the 17th and then another battle on the 20th of August. That's called the Battle of Gumbinnen. And the Russians dealt defeats to the Germans, and the Germans retreated 150 miles, and that left East Prussia nearly unguarded. So at first, it's not looking good for Germany. It's looking much better for Russia. But then the head honcho of the German army, Helmut von Moltke, and the Kaiser decided they made a very important decision. They sent two generals to the east to take command and rally the troops, and those were the aforementioned Paul von Hindenburg and his chief of staff, Erich Ludendorff. And they're going to turn into one of the great military partnerships of all time, really. I mean, they're going to work together very well. Hindenburg is more the overall leader, almost the figurehead, the inspirer, whereas Ludendorff is going to be the nuts and bolts guy who, you know, orders this division here and this division here and so on. They'll work very well together. Hindenburg took command. Ludendorff was his chief of staff. They rallied the Eastern troops, and we will see what happens in a minute. But we're going to talk very quickly. Scott has some stuff to say about Mr. Hindenburg.
All I have to say is, listener, if you heard that name and you know nothing else about him, and you wonder, wait, wasn't that giant hydrogen blimp that blew up? Oh, the Humanity, that old thing. Yes, dear listener, von Hindenburg is the namesake for the blimp. But we hope that you know more about him and his legacy than a hydrogen blimp that went up in flames. That's all I have to say. So just let people know that.
Fortunately for the Germans, his military career will have much more. It'll be much more productive and successful than the career of the blimp that was named after him. You're going to be hearing a lot about Hindenburg and Ludendorff, listener. They're going to have a big future here. Hindenburg actually was a much older man. He was in his late 60s. In fact, a lot of these generals are in their 60s and 70s. It's very different from the Civil War. If you remember the Civil War, Scott, the generals tended to be in their 40s tops. There were a few older, but not many.
No military experience, stuff like that.
Well, yeah, sometimes, yeah. A lot of them were in their 30s. And some of them were in their 20s even. So, but Hindenburg is, I think he's about 66. He had fought in the Franco-Prussian War like a lot of the top generals. He was called out of retirement. He was actually in retirement. And when they summoned him to come back and take command of this Eastern Army, he didn't even have a modern German uniform. He wore his old blue Prussian uniform. He had to get a new uniform made for him. But in addition to sending Hindenburg and Ludendorff, Moltke also sent several divisions from the Western Front. As it would turn out, they were not needed. But of course, hindsight is 20/20, and Moltke did not know that at the time. Keep in mind that the Germans were being pushed back by the Russians, and they were in danger of being surrounded. Now, then something happened that helped turn the tide, and that is, after the Battle of Gumbinnen that I mentioned earlier on August 20th, a note was found on a dead Russian officer that detailed most of the Russian plans for their upcoming offensive. Isn't that handy? So the Germans, what is this paper? Oh, look at this. It's a complete battle plan.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
So now the Germans are basically reading the mail of the Russians. In addition to that, that reminds me, by the way, of the Battle of Antietam and the Civil War.
Yes, I was just thinking that.
No cigars this time. But they didn't get the cigars, but even more importantly, they got the complete battle plan, and they don't have McClellan leading them. So they do. There is hope for the Germans still.
Right. I mean, it just boggles your mind. I guess they didn't study the Civil War because if you listen to that listener series, there's the same thing where the Confederacy drops orders, Lee's orders. And considering how important coding is in World War II and Ultra and everything else happening, it's amazing that there are armies that still aren't encoding their messages, but here we are.
Yeah, the Russians were not, at least not at this point in the war. So occasionally there would be Russian radio broadcasts, broadcasting orders, and the Germans would just pick them up. And somebody would just translate them from regular Russian to German. And so the Germans knew exactly what the Russians were doing, where they were going, what their plan was. So that is a major victory before the actual victory that we're going to see. The Germans, the Russians are almost, I don't want to say flying blind, but they are, they don't have near the knowledge of their opponent at this point that the Germans do. All right. Ready to go into the actual battle now?
Let's do it.
All right. So now we're getting to the actual key battle. Very important battle, the Battle of Tannenberg. It takes place between August 26th and August 30th, 1914. And I should say, too, let me take an aside here and say that that's a very short battle for World War One, right, Scott? World War One battles can be very long. If you think about, compare it to the Civil War. Again, I go back to the Civil War because that was only 50 years before this, and it's my main area of expertise, at least for the American history. You think about the Battle of Antietam, okay? It was September 17th, 1862. Even a longer battle, like the Battle of Gettysburg, was 3 days, okay? Big whoop. 3 days, I don't mean to be flippant. That's a horrible 3 days. But my point is that battles in the battles in World War One would be weeks sometimes or months. And they weren't really just battles in the normal sense of the word. They were campaigns. They were series of shorter battles. And so Tannenberg is kind of an exception because it's only actually technically 5 days, August 26th through 30th. Sometimes it's hard also to pin down when did it actually start and when did it begin. But we're going to go with the 26th through the 30th.
Right. I mean, I think this is, it's almost a battle of an earlier era because we don't think of it as a World War One battle, like you mentioned. The battles go on for so long that it's hard to know where a battle ends and another one begins. It's just this general waiting, hearing artillery shells, hear a whistle blow, run over a trench, retreat, maybe a mile is gained, and it's a slog. It is just an endless, endless slog. But this one isn't, so here we go.
Right. And I should mention also, too, that there's not a lot of trench warfare at this time on either front, Eastern or Western front. That's going to be a little bit later. But so you have more open battles. It's more of a war of movement at this point. But here's what happened. So the Russian force in East Prussia was divided into, as I've touched upon earlier, it was divided into the First Army under Paul von Rennenkampf. This is confusing because a lot of Russian generals have German sounding names and some German commanders have Russian sounding names. There was a lot of back and forth over the centuries. So yes, Paul von Rennenkampf, it sounds German, but he's actually the Russian commander. The Second Army was under a man named Alexander Samsonov. That definitely sounds more Russian. The First Army was on the right, which is the north, and the Second Army was on the left, further south. So let's do a mental map. It's fairly straightforward. You have the First Army, which is basically going from not necessarily the Baltic Sea coast, but not too far, coming down from the north in a straight vertical line up and down from north to south. But then between the other army is to the south of them, also vertical, basically. So the right, the Russian right is the north, and the Russian left is the south. But between them is a very swampy area called the Masurian Lakes. It was great defensive ground. There were swampland. There were many small lakes, some larger lakes. And so the two armies do not make one massive long line. They make two different lines, and which are separated, and that's going to be a big problem. Another big problem is that the two army commanders hated each other and they would not work together. At least they didn't want to. I mean, they would very grudgingly when they were forced to. There was another general in overall command of this, but he was further back. But it's going to be these two commanders, Rennenkampf and Samsonov, who are going to be the ones really calling the shots. And what this means is that the Germans could attack the two Russian armies one at a time. Instead of having the Germans were technically outnumbered 2-1, but it was kind of like 1-1 and 1-1 in two different places, if that makes sense. What do you think, Scott? I don't know if I can explain that well. But.
Well, what's funny about this is World War One. It has bits of a very modern conflict, but then there are things that don't look 20th century. With those two generals that hate each other and aren't working together, it sounds like the Revolutionary War with the Battle of Saratoga, where generals are not listening to each other. They do not. One is taking off and going in a direction the other one doesn't know anything about. So, but you know what? I think Russia is going to be just fine. So let's see how they handle it.
Let's see. Yeah. The overall Russian commander that I mentioned was the Grand Duke Nicholas. He was a relative of Tsar Nicholas, and he was barely competent. He was like one of those political generals from the Civil War. Right? he got his position because he was part of the aristocracy. The German senior commander was Hindenburg, who we mentioned a little while ago. And he was the overall commander of the one German army in the area, which was the Eighth Army. The Russians had about 500,000 men, and the Germans had only 200,000. I say only; those are big armies. But the Germans are outnumbered, as I said before, more than 2-1. But most of the Russian soldiers were new recruits, while the Germans were more professional. And the Russians had inferior transport; they had communication systems that weren't all that great. And they didn't have enough ammunition. They did have twice as much artillery than the Germans, but the German guns were better, and their artillery units were better. They were just more professional, they're better trained.
Right, and we'll get into that in a lot more detail later. Just one very short fact I'll mention about Germany in World War One is that they had 3,000 flamethrowers. Russia, I don't believe, had any, so... That's a very small fact. Artillery played a much bigger role, but there was no parity at all between weapons. Germany was way ahead.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, Germany was very technologically advanced for the time. They had the strongest economy in Europe. They were just advanced, and the Russians just weren't there. And also, German commanders were in general much better than the Russian ones, and. The reason for that goes back to what I was discussing earlier, and Scott's going to fill in a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think you covered the bases, so I won't say a lot, but what happened is that it goes back to the Teutonic Knights, but then in the 17th and 18th centuries, there's a number of Prussian rulers, beginning with Frederick William, but they recognize the importance of a standing army with an elite officer corps. Is how you develop a powerful state in a remote part of this loosely knit German empire. And for a long time, Prussia was called, I think, what was it? An army without a nation, something like that.
Or an army seeking a nation. Yeah, something like that. They were very tough warriors, man.
And when you talked about Frederick the Great, he launched wars from 1740 to 1763. And Napoleon looked up to him the way that Julius Caesar looked up to Alexander the Great when he famously looked up at a statue of him and pined to be like him. So it was so powerful. Prussia was contending with the Habsburgs for control over the different German political entities. So won't say anything more to there, but Prussia has its act together. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, they took war very seriously, the Prussians and the Germans after them. They were professionals. All right. Moving on to the battle. The Russian Second Army was threatening Königsberg, but its advance had been slowed by rough terrain and supply shortages. Supplies are going to be a major issue for all sides throughout this war. It's hard to get enough stuff up to the front, and the further away you get from your own base of supplies, in other words, the further you get away from your own country, the worse the problem becomes. Men have to have food. If people don't eat, they die. So you've got to feed your troops. And if you don't feed them enough, then they won't be able to fight as well. Or they might even go into rebellion. And that's going to happen a few times too. Anyway, they also suffered from a lack of ammunition and artillery shells constantly. But so what Hindenburg did was he sent a corps. A corps is a part of an army. It's going to have tens of thousands of people. Maybe 60, 70,000, 80, depends on the situation and which nation you're talking about. But this corps was commanded by a man named Hermann von Francois. And again, here we go.
French, German, what is it?
Originally, his ancestors were French, but they found their way to Germany at some point and They didn't change their name. Anyway, so these guys went by rail around to the Russian Second Army's left flank. So the left, so remember the Russians are coming from the east to the west. So the left flank of the Russians is the south. The Russians didn't notice this. They didn't know what was going on, what the Germans were doing. Hindenburg sent two other corps to march directly toward the Second Army. And the remaining German force, which is part of an army, kept the First Army in place. And Hindenburg is channeling Robert E. Lee here because, and I'm sorry for all the Civil War references, folks, but y'all are thinking, dadgummit, that's already like five and I'm in the first battle. But we're just going to throw them out. We're going to throw Revolution and Civil War. We can't waste all that research we did, right, Scott?
Yeah, you got to empty out your notebook.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of Americans especially are very familiar with the Civil War and the battle, so I think it'll help illustrate what's going on in this war, which is not necessarily as familiar. One of the fundamental rules of warfare is you never divide your army if you are faced by a superior foe, right? If you have 200,000, your opponent has 500,000, you don't want to cut your army in two and send half of them here and half of them there. You want to stick together. But Robert E. Lee violated that several times, especially at the famous Battle of Chancellorsville. And now Hindenburg is doing it. He leaves part of his army to just keep an eye on the First Army, the Russian First Army, and make sure they don't do anything funny. But then he does this sneak attack and flank attack, as well as a head-on attack against the Second Army. Hindenburg ordered Francois to attack, but he actually held off for a while. And then Samsonov, the Russian commander, attacked the Germans near him, but Francois attacked his left flank. And so there's kind of a little dance going on here. But on the 29th, the German commander, Francois, marched around the left. You always want to try to get around the opponent's army if you can and get in their rear. And then you've got people attacking from the front and the back, and it's all over. Francois, the German commander, not a Frenchman, but the German commander, began to encircle the Russian Second Army. The commander of the Russian First Army, further to the north, was ordered to send soldiers to help Samsonov, but he stalled and the reinforcements didn't make it on time. And before long, the Russian Second Army was totally surrounded. Many of the Russian soldiers panicked, they broke and ran, and many, many surrendered. The commander, General Samsonov, was so despairing. He said, "What is the Tsar going to say? He sent me to do a job and I failed," or something like that. He went into the woods and shot himself. Very tragic situation. So that was it. The whole Russian Second Army was pretty much wiped out. Germany lost 1,800 killed, 7,500 wounded, and 4,700 missing. That's about 14,000 total casualties. The Russians lost 50,000 killed, 100,000 captured. That's 150,000 total casualties. That's just about a whole army wiped out. So to put it in perspective, the Russians' casualties were more than 10 times what Germany suffered. Total disaster for Russia. The Germans also captured between about 350 and 500 Russian big guns, you know, artillery pieces. There were so many Russian prisoners that it took 60 trains to take all the Russian prisoners to prisoner camps. How about that, Scott? That's not a good day for Russia.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like people might not be pleased with the Tsar and be seeking alternate forms of government. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but it's starting to make me wonder those things.
Right. Yeah, certainly. I think you have the gift of prophecy, Scott.
Of things over 100 years ago, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, yeah, every loss like this is going to really make people in Russia question things, for sure. Now, so the aftermath, after the battle. Now, the battle took place 19 miles from the village of Tannenberg. So it really should have been named something else, but Scott was talking about PR earlier. The Germans pulled off a PR coup here. They named it after the village of Tannenberg, even though it wasn't all that close to Tannenberg. And this was done out of vengeance because Tannenberg had been the site of a Polish defeat of the Teutonic Knights in 1410. So 500 years earlier, Germany had lost in this general's spot. And so now they're going to stick it to the Poles, the Slavs. you know, in the form of the Russians. Obviously, the Russians and the Poles are not the same people, but a lot of Poles are fighting in the Russian army at this time because there is no Polish state. Many of the Polish people, I should say, were in Russia. So, Scott, you had something you wanted to add about that, too.
Yeah, I think this is a fun fact because military people love military history. And if there's a chance for symbolism, they're not going to pass it up. I mean, just as an example of this, James had mentioned earlier that Prussia began when the Teutonic Knights, they colonized Prussia during the 13th and 14th centuries, and they pushed back or overran Slavs in the area. Well, the Knights were crushed by Poles and Lithuanians in 1410 at the Battle of Tannenberg. So this is a way for them to exact revenge. And other military leaders have done this at different times in history for symbolisms to sort of right the wrong of a past. For example, when the French government called on Germany for an armistice during World War II, Hitler dictated that the surrender be formalized at the exact same spot where Germany had signed its armistice ending World War I. And when Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish Republic, won the Greco-Turkish War in 1922, which led to Turkey's independence, he was said that he had avenged the Trojans against the Greeks in the Trojan War, like as if he's Hector and he's, you know, fighting and avenging Achilles and the others like that. So what can I say? I mean, military commanders, they love symbolism and they'll take it where they can get it. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Now, this battle is going to be Germany's greatest World War I victory. So here we go.
It's downhill from here, guys.
Yeah, it's not going to get any better, Germany fans. Sorry, but it was a big victory, but it was largely symbolic as well. One of the books I read about World War I in researching for this series was written by this British scholar, Hugh Strachan. And he writes this. He said, "Victory where the Germans had not expected it, that is in the East, was used to cover over its absence where it was actually most needed, in the West. Hindenburg and Ludendorff became national heroes. The Germans were needing a hero at this time. By this time, fighting was already going on in the West as well. And Hindenburg and Ludendorff are going to become more and more famous, more and more heroic, and eventually they're going to pretty much be running the country, but more on that later. In early September, the First Army, the other army that the Russians had, was also defeated at the Battle of the Masurian Lakes, and it had to retreat. So the German victories at Tannenberg and the Masurian Lakes meant that the Russian advance into Germany was halted. Germany no longer had to worry about the so-called Russian steamroller. The Russian steamroller runs out of steam pretty early.
So Russia really failed on one front. I mean, like you said, if they succeeded anywhere, it was inadvertent. They did achieve one of their goals. It was at a terrible cost, but that was that they moved forces away from the Western Front to the Eastern Front, and that's going to change things early on that we'll see more of in the next episode. But at least for now, things look all aces for Germany. But, you know, this battle did have an effect that it's going to hinder them down the road, a month down the road, in fact.
Right.
There's another battle that you're mentioning that's happening August 23rd to September 11th, Lemberg. What's happening there?
Yeah, let's sneak in another battle or two just to kind of close the book on the East for a while. After this, we're going to go out west for a little while for a few episodes and other places. So the Austrian, let's talk about Austria again. We saw how Austria was basically booted out of Serbia. You know, the Serbs said, nope, not in my house, go home. And so they had to retreat in disgrace from Serbia, a nation that they thought was far inferior to them militarily, if not in other ways as well. The Austrian Supreme Commander, Konrad von Hotzendorf, and it's interesting that almost every book I read and every video I've watched just calls him Konrad. They call him by his first name, I guess because they don't want to write out or say Hotzendorf. Hotzendorf, it's got the O with the two little dots on it, but he was feeling very confident despite what happened in Serbia, and he had a complicated plan to let the Russians advance and then swing around to the north. So he wants a piece of Russia too. The Russian army was being reinforced, and by September 1st, it had twice as many men as the Austrian army that it faced. On September 3rd, the Russians took Lemberg, which is part of Austria-Hungary, so they've crossed into Austrian territory. Lemberg, I should say, is the modern-day Ukrainian city of Lviv. I don't even know if I said that right. It's spelled L-V-I-V. I listened to it, but I didn't really understand it. In Polish, it's Lviv, I think. And again, sorry if I didn't do that right, people, but I tried. Lemberg is certainly easier to say for me. Anyway, the Austrian army had to flee before the Russians. They had to retreat to the Carpathian foothills. The Austrian army was plagued by problems, and this is going to be something that is a problem all throughout the war, because among other things, you had linguistic differences. That's a big problem. We talked previously, Scott and I did, about how many different languages, orders, and proclamations and all that had to be issued in. And sometimes non-Slavic units within the Austrian army, like let's say Austrian German people or Hungarian units, they would actually attack Slavic units who were fighting for Austria. They attacked their fellow soldiers in their own army. Let's, you know, like maybe Czechs or maybe Poles or maybe Ruthenians or you name it. They thought they were Russians. And sometimes Slavs fighting for Austria would desert, and a few even defected to Russia. There's going to be a famous example later in the war that we'll talk about later. But and Scott, this is not a new thing, is it, with an empire?
Right. It's a tale as old as time. And another example of World War One, where it's part of this different world than what we recognize. And when you run an empire, the downside is there's a lot of different languages. There's not a universal identity. I mean, you might realize there's an emperor somewhere high above, but you all didn't go to the same school speaking the same language, reciting the same national anthem, and all the other things that make up a nation state. This issue of an empire fighting another empire and then people defect because they realize they have more in common the other side, there are so many examples like this. And one very short one is that I'll mention. In 1402, at the Battle of Ankara, in which the Ottoman Empire fought Timur the Tatar, the powerful Central Asian ruler, the Ottomans had recently conquered a number of Tatars that were fighting for them. And in the battle, they defected from the Ottomans to fight for Timur. So happens all over the place. And that's why at this time, a lot of states are loving the idea of nationalism. We have to get these people closer together and have a common identity so they don't do stuff like this. So World War One, sort of interesting things happening there that happened throughout history. But anyway, back to what's going on. What happened to some of the different units that...
In this campaign, when the Austrians were retreating before the Russian advance, units became lost, sometimes for days. And in the end, the Austrian army took over 420,000 casualties.
Oof.
100,000 dead, 220,000 wounded, and 100,000 or more captured. There's going to be literally millions of prisoners of war throughout this war. It's just the numbers are staggering. The Russians lost about 250,000, which is a ton, but it's much less than the Austrians, and they had about 40,000 captured. But the Russians in this campaign for Lemberg, they pushed the front about 100 miles into the Carpathian Mountains, and they completely surrounded the Austrian fortress of Przemysl, which that's a Polish word. But of course, as we mentioned earlier, there is no state of Poland. The Poles are divided amongst the Russians, the Austrians, and the Germans. But anyway, so this ancient fortress and very strong fortress of Przemysl is surrounded by the Russians, and the Russians started a siege which would last for over 100 days. This battle, where the Russians, even though the Russians were taking it on the chin up north in, against Germany, they're winning against Austria. And it's severely damaged the army. It destroyed a large portion of its trained officers, and it crippled Austria. I'm not sure Austria ever really recovers from this. They are, in some ways, a bit of a paper tiger anyway. We've already talked about the cultural and ethnic and linguistic divisions, but there's other issues as well. Austria's... Well, let's just say it may not make it too much longer. But the Russian victory at Lemberg helped soften the blow of their defeat at Tannenberg. It didn't make up for it, but it made it, at least they had one victory. The Russians as we mentioned earlier, they laid siege to Przemysl. They planned to take it. They wanted to take Krakow. They wanted to take Budapest. They had big plans, and they began their siege of Przemysl, the major fortress, on September 26th. To counter this, the Germans sent four army corps to East Prussia. These froze thousands of Russian soldiers at the Vistula River by conducting several minor attacks. In other words, they prevented, the Germans came in and provided a lot of stability and a lot more punch for the Austrians, and they kept the Russians from realizing these great designs of taking over a big chunk of Austria-Hungary. And we're going to see this several times. The Germans are constantly having to come over and bail out the Austrians. Kind of reminds me of World War II, Scott, when how many times did Hitler have to send German troops to bail out the Italians? The Austrians are kind of like the Italians of this war, but the junior partner of the alliance, we'll put it that way. I don't want to insult anybody and say they were incompetent, because they are going to have some victories, but they are constantly looking to Germany for help. I'll finish up here, and then you have the last word. The Germans captured the city of Łódź on December 6th. Again, that's part of modern day Poland, but at the time it's in Austria-Hungary, but had been taken by Russia. So the Germans take it back. The Russians fought off an Austrian attack at Warsaw. There was a battle in Warsaw, also called the Battle of the Vistula. A few more battles occurred, and then the Eastern Front settled into more or less a stalemate for the first part of the winter. We've seen this in other wars, that winter fighting, especially in the more northern and cold parts of the world, doesn't really happen a whole lot because it's pointless. All right. That's all I've got for Russia, Germany, and Austria in the Eastern Front.
Right. It's very different from earlier times in history where you simply couldn't fight in the winter because where would your livestock graze? They couldn't. So winter war is just sort of called off. Not the case in the modern world, listeners. But what is happening here, what James described, is everyone realizes that this isn't the war they expected. Many of the great powers had plans that they hoped if we prosecute this successfully, the war will be over in a few months, or at least the signs of it ending will become very clear. And in the next episode, when we look at the Battle of the Marne, we'll see the what else is going on that makes this crystal clear. But once we settle into winter, they see that this isn't going to end anytime soon. No one is getting knocked out the way we expected. This is involving hundreds of thousands of soldiers who are dug in and entrenched. And to show how attitudes change, in August 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm famously promised his departing troops that they'd return before the autumn leaves fell. Well, even at the time, the German command realized this wouldn't happen. The chief of the German general staff predicted that the war would take 18 months, between 18 months and 2 years, and French and Austrian opposites thought it would take a similar amount of time. But they realize now this could go on for years, because each fielding army has millions of soldiers. They're supported by resources of entire nations. But what's interesting is that no one could foresee at this time or guess that it would last as long as it did, that this war would go on for years and would claim a total of 10 million lives. So we're about to dive deep into the belly of the beast. Anything else before we sign off for this episode, James?
No, that's all I have. I will say that I keep thinking of Civil War parallels, how it seems like this happens so often in wars when both sides just think, oh, we're going to whip up on the other side. We'll have it done in weeks or maybe months, but, you know, done by Christmas. In both the Civil War and World War One, things didn't turn out that way. People, the leaders of the nations had no idea, except for a few far-sighted people like Moltke, like you mentioned, but for the most part, people didn't understand what they were getting into. They had no idea. They just didn't understand how much warfare had changed and how hard it was going to be to deal a knockout blow to the opponent.
Right. We're going to see what's going on and why these attitudes are shifting so dramatically. We're going to shift from the Eastern Front to the Western Front and see what's going on between France and Germany. See you then. All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic spy masters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivy, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.